This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Charlie Thompson's a native son of Franklin County, Virginia, the so-called moonshine capital of the world. Sure enough, Charlie's ancestors were involved in that industry, so he wanted to investigate. What he found was a complicated picture of poverty and power that was exposed in the famous conspiracy trial of 1935. Charlie Thompson's education and curriculum director at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. His new book is called Spirits of Just Men, Mountaineers, Liquor Bosses, and Lawmen in the Moonshine Capital of the World, and he joins us here today. Welcome, Charlie. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from the studios of WCQS in Asheville is Dan Pierce. Dan similarly investigated moonshine and its connection to the sport of NASCAR. His book is titled Real NASCAR, White Lightning, Red Clay, and Big Bill France. He's also the chair of the History Department at UNC Asheville. Welcome to you, Dan.
Thank you, Frank.
Charlie, let me start with you. Your book is as much about the culture of moonshine in the 20s and 30s as about discovering your own roots. And one of the things that strikes me in thinking about the book is how moonshine itself has been romanticized in pop culture. But it wasn't until just before before he died, I guess, that your grandfather talked with you about this. So it wasn't so romantic as far as he was concerned, I guess, huh?
Right. That was my first experience realizing that it's a much more complicated story about poverty, culture, and actually agriculture. Many different people from the community of Endicott and Franklin County were farmers, and they were turning a product, corn that barely made back the price of the seed, into a value-added product.
And so this was an act of desperation in many cases. I mean, there wasn't much else you could do.
There wasn't. This was the Depression, after all. There had been, if you can imagine, 77 different legal distilleries in Franklin County in the late 1800s alone. All of those people who had been employed in that industry became unemployed, and suddenly the farm prices began to decline, and the great crash of 1929 was no news to the farmers of rural America. They had been in depression for 10 years before that. So where were the people to turn? There were no jobs in textiles. There were no jobs in the coal mines. So they turned to products that they had. And according to a federal trial in 1935 that you already mentioned, 99% of the people were involved. The Wickersham report from the federal government said that 99% of the people in Franklin County were in this industry. That's an exaggeration, but it shows how many people needed to turn to this product to survive.
Right, and of course there are no real programs, so these people are out of work. Farm prices are down. People are out of work. There are no jobs programs, so folks are going to do something if the government doesn't step in, and it wasn't inclined to do that back then, to do something. People are going to make their own way in the world.
They did. And, of course, because of Prohibition that started in 1919, there was increased national demand. And this liquor that was coming out of small communities where there's rhododendron-covered springs and pure mountain water began to have cachet. Even before the Prohibition period started, people had heard of Shooting Creek, Virginia, where some fine liquor flowed, and several of those distilleries I was talking about had made advertisements about that. You better buy your liquor now because you know the shortage is coming and so forth. I found those when I was doing research.
And that clean country water, goes way back. The marketing of clean country water goes way back before even Coors.
That's right.
Coors Light. Well, Dan, let me talk to you. Some of the points in Charlie's book dispel the stereotypes surrounding moonshine, this hillbilly, uneducated, drunk moonshiner. And I know you looked a lot into the perception of moonshine. Do you think those stereotypes persist still?
Well, they do. And one of the interesting things about stereotypes, it's a two-way street because they're promoted by outsiders, but also there are people on the inside. I mean, in our area, we've had the late dear departed Popcorn Sutton did a lot to promote the image of the moonshiner with the long beard and the short vocabulary and this kind of outlandish character wearing overalls and that type of thing. So it persists, but he was very savvy in terms of marketing his own image. And, you know, I think that's something that that people have used, but it is something that, you know, people, you know, want to see in this region. There's kind of, you know, a recent growth in kind of the cachet of moonshine. And so people are still kind of both outside and inside promoting this image.
Well, and I guess that's one of the things that really gives lie to the image of the ignorant hillbilly is just how clever they were even at manipulating their own bad image to turn that into a marketing tool. And who suspects that guy of coming up with something that clever? And it was more than just that, wasn't it, Charlie? I mean, this was a very intricate, sophisticated network that had to be involved in order for this whole system to work.
Right. Well, just to reiterate the stereotypes, the county is known as the moonshine capital of the world. And I think that some of that's probably proven back during the 30s. And now people are wearing T-shirts that say it. I own one of those T-shirts. But it is much more complicated. And when it instantly complicates things when I say that my grandfather never drank his entire life. And there were many people who were very religious, praying people who were making moonshine and so forth, many who sent their children on to college and entered the middle class through this illegal product. But part of the problem was because it was illegal and people had to be very secretive about it, they were easily exploited. And so some of the ringleaders of the county, the richest people, and the most powerful, including the sheriff and the Commonwealth attorney, began charging moonshiners for every load hauled, every batch made. And suddenly, people in the county were turning against each other out of suspicion and so forth. And then things got nasty.
And, of course, it's not only prohibition and dry counties. It's also paying a federal tax. So it's one way of getting around keeping the price lower.
That's right.
Go ahead.
And there, at that point during Prohibition, there were no taxes to pay on liquor. All liquor was illegal.
Right.
And then later it became a Treasury Department issue in the 1930s. That's when the investigations began over revenue.
Dan, we talked about stereotypes and sort of the cleverness and the how intricate and sophisticated these networks are. What are some of the other things that gets left out when we focus on the stereotype? What is it we're not seeing about that industry?
Well, I think a lot of what Charlie touches on in his book is really to reveal not only the complicated nature, but the intelligence of a lot of these people. I mean, these were sophisticated operations. When you get into the 1920s in particular, the industry changes, and it actually becomes more of an industry rather than this kind of craft thing. And so you have, you know, a highly organized industry in many ways. These people, the word that jumped out at me a lot when I was looking at these people was entrepreneurial. And that's not a word we generally associate with these people. But, you know, there were all kinds of levels. One of the things that I think is often missed, when you look at this, you see the moonshiner at the still. One, you see the wrong image of a still because these became you know, major industrial productions, and not the little pot still that you associate with the moonshiner. But you know, there are all sorts of levels, and there's all sorts of sophistication in terms of marketing and transportation. And the one thing that a lot of people miss is the whole notion of finance, that there are so many people, or there are people at the top levels who are financing these. They're very savvy individuals. A lot of their families, one reason they don't like to talk about it, because their families have become very successful and very very wealthy by taking that money and then putting it into the economy. So it is amazing when you look at a lot of these counties, and there are at least four counties that call themselves the moonshine capital of the world, including Wilkes County, North Carolina, since this is a North Carolina radio right. station. We have to mention that. But in those counties, you know, it's amazing how much illegal liquor production permeated the whole economy. And And I think that's something that Charlie really brings out in looking at this one community in this one county, which that is, it is an extreme example, but I think it really does illustrate how pervasive this was.
Well, tell us about the economic impact, but also this idea that it's not just, you know, me and Ma turning out some bottles of liquor here and picking up a few bucks. It is an industry. You might actually be part of a corporation, in a sense, working for another financier. Charlie?
Yeah. The statistics are staggering. From 1929 to 1935, federal prosecutor, Sterling Hutchison, went into the N&W Railroad records and found that there had been, in 6 years, 33 million pounds of sugar and 13 million pounds of cornmeal, 35 tons of yeast. And this is just his partial records. That doesn't count what people are hauling in trucks and so forth. And then the most amazing statistic is 1,250,000 5-gallon tins. And so we have 6 million gallons of whiskey flowing out of this county. And yes, it's a huge industry. And some of the small-timers, people who were the mom-and-pop, were coerced into working for this big corporation, as you say. And in some cases, the law was cracking down on the moonshiners, confiscating the equipment, taking it in the front door of the courthouse and selling it out the back. That there were witnesses who talked about that in this trial.
And what do you think about your grandfather? Was it that he didn't want to talk about it, or that you just never asked? Or it does seem that he was reluctant somehow if he'd never mentioned it.
Right. Because people had become middle class and the farmers were able to afford all the amenities of suburban life in a way, even though they're in a rural area with electricity and plumbing, and then their incomes began to come from other places, people knew that the general public wouldn't understand that life of poverty and so forth, and so they just gradually began to leave that out of the conversation. And so I grew up not really questioning where our farm came from and how it was procured, and deeply, deeply respecting my grandfather. And I think that he wanted to protect his family from any negative reputation. And not only my family, but as I started doing oral histories throughout the community where he's from, and I did dozens of these with different families, there was a lot of reluctance. But gradually, now in this time period, people are saying, no, they did work hard. They did have it rough. They did the best they could with what they had. And it's a strong argument for people doing the best they can with what they have. And as soon as they got an education, as soon as they had paved roads going into their communities and so forth, they took advantage of those and became upstanding people, many of them going on into World War II, more at a greater percentage than most other regions in the country, and then becoming contributing members as suburbia arose and people went into manufacturing. They were right out of that community.
Yeah, you know, Dan, it does raise an interesting question about how people saw it at the time, how people saw themselves with respect to the rest of their community, and how we have romanticized it since. I mean, it seems that given, especially with respect to NASCAR and all the kind of blaze of glory that goes around these, hot rod, entrepreneurs, the idea that maybe people were embarrassed at the thought of, first, that they were so poor that they did it, second, that they were breaking the law. Is that a conflict that you see in North Carolina as well, that people that we have two very different images then and now?
Yes, I think that's it's very true. And, a lot of the things I've seen, it is kind of interesting that it is, part of the change has taken place in recent years that I think people are more willing to talk about it. And it doesn't quite have the stigma that it once did. But it's not only from the outside that you have the stigma. It's also in their local communities. I mean, if you want to move into middle-class respectability, you don't talk about your moonshiner kinfolk. And it's I remember one interview that a guy did, he wrote a book on this. He was talking to an old gentleman, and he asked him some questions about, and actually one of the interesting things I've found is that people will often talk about things that they did, but they generally won't tell you about things that other people, that they know other people did. And as this old gentleman said, I don't believe I'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way it's been. But again, in recent years, I think in very recent years, part of it's distance, and the part that there is this kind of cachet again for moonshine that people are starting to own up and to claim their roots. Although there's still a lot of people, particularly if you look at families who have done very well, and their kind of seed money for doing well came out of the illegal liquor business. They really don't want to talk about that still.
So, Charlie, what was the experience for you in writing this book and looking at your own family history and another bigger issue, moonshine?
I've done a lot of work with people from Latin America, a lot of people who are leaving farms and coming to North Carolina to work on farms here and so forth. And this, the biggest revelation to me is how these waves of immigrants who have come to this country included me at one point, included my family. And that's, we were at one point the those who were living without, and we found a way to become part of a contributing society. And that took some soul searching on my part, and I realized as I found out about this, the Ulster Irish people who first came to the Appalachians and so forth, that they were without anything, and now look, and now I was able to write this book as a result of those wonderful ancestors who really worked hard to get me where I am. And that, I think that's the spirits of the just men in another sense.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Charlie Thompson, Education and Curriculum Director at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. His new book is called Spirits of Just Men, Mountaineers, Liquor Bosses, and Lawmen in the Moonshine Capital of the World. Dan Pierce, a professor and chair of history in the Department of UNC Asheville, also author of Real NASCAR. Thank both of you for being on the program. Good
thank
to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.